latest episode of the Brushwaters Union podcast. I'm your host and general president of the Brushwaters Union, Simon Berman. This month, I am joined once more by maybe the hardest working man in tabletop war games, Sean Sutter, creator of Relic Blade and creator of the new on Kickstarter game, Cursebreaker, also in the Relic Blade world. Sean, thanks for coming back, man. Always great to talk to you.
Oh, yeah, I'm excited to be here. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think this is the third time we've had you on. We've talked about Relic Blade in the past. For people who don't know about Relic Blade, it is a skirmish miniatures game that is created wholly by Sean here, who does the concept art, sculpts the miniatures, does it pretty much everything, except maybe casting the miniatures. Is that still about right?
Yeah, exactly. I do all the illustration and sculpture and game design, and then I also run my small business. So I really approach it more like an independent artist, my studio practice, instead of making pottery or making, you know, paintings or prints or all of the things that a normal artist would do. I make models and games and sell model kits instead of art prints, you know? So it's funny. I really approached it as like my peers in art school were fine artists. And so I approached it from that same attitude. So I'm a small business, but, you know, my goal has never been to, like, grow a big new games workshop. I'm definitely an independent guy doing independent things. And if people are vibing with it, then that's perfect. And so what I really am after is a small, fun audience that's excited to explore the world with me.
Well, you definitely have that. I mean, you've already done 3 or 4 Relic Blade Kickstarters in the past?
Yeah, this one that's going now is my 7th.
7th. Wow. Okay. I was dramatically under, but this is very cool. Cause you know, Relic Blade, it's a miniature skirmish game. You've got all these very cool and thematic warbands. But this new one that is currently on Kickstarter, and has more than doubled its funding goal in the last 10 days or so, is called Cursebreaker. And this is, while it's set in the Relic Blade universe, it is a standalone game. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, I wrote it really, for a lot of different reasons, from a game designer perspective, like really a gameplay experience that I was super excited to deliver. But then also as a creator of Relic Blade and an independent creator, it's sort of like a source book, right? Like, but a new game mode. So when you go to this region that's totally destroyed and crazy with feral magic,
it's like the lost.
Yeah, exactly. The Shattered Lands, the laws of reality are changed. And obviously the laws of a tabletop miniature game's reality are its rules. And so on a meta level, when the laws of reality change, the rules change. And so part of this realm is that the magic is unbound from intention. So like the sources of magic, the like pillars of reality are the magic itself is like disconnected from those pillars that are like intention. They could be like gods, but they're more like sources of creation. And so in the Relic Blade world, in this Shattered Lands area, the magic is disconnected and just wild. So any magician that has like learning can command the magic. Whereas in the normal world, you'd need learning and the magic would need to choose you. So like divinely, not arcanely chosen. So like there's a one of the wizards in Relic Blade is the Flame Bearer. He's like this madman, wandering madman that's been like branded by fire. And so he has like his body's changed by this connection to magic. While in colleges of magic, they study different lores of magic, and even like the headmaster of, say, the College of Magic might not really be able to cast spells, or maybe has some connection to one school of magic and can evoke some spells. But that led to like a lot of frustration among magic users because, you know, imagine you go to the school of magic. You dedicate your life to this like really extreme esoteric learning and you gain no real power other than like the political power of having this degree. So a lot of them are disenchanted sort of on and frustrated. And so when the call of this area where magic is free to whoever is willing to take it is a major draw. And once these magicians travel there, the feeling of being overwhelmed by magic and being able to control it is often too much, and they don't return to normal life. So you play as, in Relic Blade, you command a party of adventurers, and you are like kind of a patron, or extra planar patron of these adventurers, right, leading them on their quest. In this game, you actually play as the magician, and you, when you enter the Shattered Lands, you have all this power, and you're able to cast spells in force from any school of magic you want. So you can like mix and match your schools. You could be like a holy necromancer, like who cares? Because the holy magic is disconnected from whatever holy source.
Yeah, yeah.
And necromancy is disconnected from whatever dark, horrible source it comes from. So, and it's like a really fun area where you can just like really play with magic. And so that's like in lore, that's the area. And then from a game design perspective, that's how it works. It's like very flexible, where the magic system is, I could talk all about game mechanics. I don't want to go too crazy, but like, sure, it's super fun. And lore wise, you play as just a magician, and you can like hire some champions to fight on your side, and you summon lots of creatures. So your warband is your magician and like the spells that you cast, but usually you don't use a ton of miniatures, but it plays more like an exciting competitive puzzle because of the way the spells work.
That's cool. I mean, when I saw it described as a wizard battle game, I was sold right there, because that's like, you know, such a classic part of fantasy gaming and the genre. So I mean, that's super exciting in itself.
It's funny because like, I think part of me felt like there's no reason to ever write a wizard battle game, because like Magic the Gathering is a wizard battle game.
Sure.
You know, Frostgrave is a wizard battle game. In a lot of ways, the best part of Warhammer Fantasy Battles was the wizard battle that happened in it. And I always felt like in D&D and stuff, I feel a little bit like left out on the magic. Like, I don't want to have to study a bunch of spells. I don't want to have to like think as hard as a wizard has to think.
Sure.
If that makes sense. You know, I don't, and like magic is a good example, like deck building, like you're going to go through X number of spells and figure out the combos. Like, I know people listening to this play magic and get it.
Yeah.
But also as people who understand magic, they also understand how like overwhelming it can be and frustrating it can be. So with this magic system that I wrote, it's a lot more like, I don't want to mischaracterize it, but the spells and how they work on an easy to learn system. Mm-hmm. But that system interconnects in interesting ways. So it's a little bit more like if someone was like teaching you how to play with Legos. It's not hard to learn how to play with Legos, but all of the ways you can creatively put them together leads to complexity. So the complexity is in play rather than in learning the systems.
Very cool. Yeah, I noticed there's talk about a dice mechanic for casting spells and stealing your opponent's dice. That sounds really interesting to me. So it sounds like you're sort of always engaged, even if your opponent is doing stuff. Is that kind of accurate?
Yeah, so the core like game design mechanic is input randomness versus output randomness. So Relic Blade is an output randomness game, and most miniatures games are, in that you try to do something like swing an axe at a goblin. And so you say, I'm going to swing an axe at a goblin. You roll the dice, and the outcome of whether you hit or miss is the randomized part. If you're good at it, you'll hit. And then how much damage you do is the randomized part. So the output at that point is random. And whereas with Cursebreaker, the input is random. So at the start of the round, you roll all of your power dice, and each die is assigned to a different school of magic. So I might have 3 fire dice and 2 ocean dice. I roll them, and each die face result is a specific spell. So I will know then that I'll have 3 different fire magic spells at my disposal and 2 different ocean spells at my disposal. I line them up next to the cards that remind me what the spells are, so you aren't like, you don't have to memorize what anything is. And then on your turn, you can, when you activate, you can move and cast 2 spells. Then every magician does that, and every magician activates twice per round. So you're moving around and setting up traps and casting spells, but the outcome of those spells is assured. So if you cast a fireball, it always does 2 damage. It doesn't matter. Okay. Like you hit, you know you have it. You can look at what you're doing. And then the other thing is, there, the objectives in the game are cursed objects. So they're like repositories of magic. So in this realm, there's all this magic floating around, and then these hateful items are where the magic gets trapped.
Okay.
And then as the magic is trapped in there, it evokes the spells and like the hateful memories. So like one of them is like a basilisk skull.
Sure.
And so the skull of this basilisk will evoke curses that are related to like the cursed hateful life of these like arcane creatures. Yeah. So you as a magician are drawn there because there's magic trapped in these items, and you can draw the magic out. And so ones are the dice that are shifting power. So if you can spend your ones to steal ones from objects or other magicians. And so you end up, the more dice you have, the more likely you'll roll ones. And so the more likely both that you'll be able to steal magic, but also more likely that others can steal from you. And if you don't cast, if you don't spend your ones, then that magic will leave you of its own accord, because it's magic that wants to leave. So if you don't pay attention to it, it will find a cursed object and get trapped in another cursed object and be cast against you as spells. So like there's a fun flow of magic where you start with 5 dice. Each player has 5 dice. The objects have like 2 or 3 dice per objective, and there are 2 or 3 objectives in play. And then you'll start with 5, but then your opponent's winning. You only have 3 dice, but you're more likely to get initiative, and then you stealing. And then by the end you won and you had 10 dice, and it feels like really crazy. Cause when you have that many dice, you have access to like basically any spell you want to cast. Whereas if you have fewer dice, you're working from a really limited set. And so that feeling is always designed toward being able to see all the way to the end of the round, and being able to predict the outcomes of what your opponent can, what spells your opponent can cast, where monsters are going to move and attack. And so it puts you in that wizard mindset where you're like, all right, a barbarian will kick down the door and see what they can do. But you have this moment where the door is kicked down, and as a wizard, time freezes, and you know exactly where to place a spell, where to cast there, what you can do. And then when it goes into real time, you know, suddenly everything's exploding and you come out unscathed because you planned it perfect. Yeah. And so it definitely plays more like a puzzle where you see your pieces, you see what Tetris blocks are coming, and you know exactly where to put them and win. Instead of wanting to swing an axe and rolling a die to see if it happened. So, you know, this play style of planning and being able to see ahead and wrestle with like the perfect move, that play style will really apply, you know, appeal to some people. And interestingly, the people who want more of a fly by the seat of your pants barbarian game, that's Relic Blade. So really it's like they play off each other in a fun way, and use the same miniatures, use the same terrain. So it's a fun way for me to take the world I've been building and deliver like a totally new play experience. Just have a ton of fun with dice. I really like rolling dice, and I like moving dice around. I love stealing dice from people. So, I mean, in a game, I don't think I've ever stolen someone's dice.
Well, good. Well, we won't hold that against you if you did. But so speaking of Relic Blade, so this set comes with some new warbands that are also available for Relic Blade play. You can use them in either game.
Yeah, precisely. Basically, all of the miniatures in the new Kickstarter are, at their core, they are Relic Blade sets for Relic Blade. So they come with Relic Blade character cards. They are Relic Blade characters in the world of Relic Blade. You know, they are 100% Relic Blade releases. And Cursebreaker is a book, cards, and tokens for a game that uses those miniatures.
Sure.
But it's also has lore and is a source book for Relic Blade, but it's a different rule set.
Right.
I've struggled to figure out like what the perfect analogy is. Like I've thought about like Mario and Mario Kart. Like it's not the same.
Yeah, I can see that. Right. It's in the same world, but yeah. That's a pretty good analogy, I think.
But they aren't in cars in Cursebreaker. So
it's
still Mario jumping around. But like, yeah, or Mario and Mario Party, maybe. But anyways, it's hard to think of the perfect analogy, but basically, like, as an independent person making independent games, I'm working within my means, you know. If I wrote a new game with a new setting, like I did with Sludge, like, I'm spread more thin. Whereas with this, any release I do for Cursebreaker is for Relic Blade and Relic Blade for Cursebreaker, and my fan base that already owns Relic Blade will be ready to go on a new adventure with me just straight from the book. And it's also miniature agnostic, technically. Like it says explicitly, use any miniatures you want and reskin monsters to fit your collection. So I want people to be able to play it. It's very fun.
That's cool. So the two new factions, I'm excited about the Severed Hand in particular, but you also got the Guild Champions, but I'd love to hear more about the Severed Hand first off, if you're up for that.
Yeah, so the Severed Hand they're both neutral factions. So in Relic Blade, there's good guys and bad guys, and then you can hire neutral guys to your warband. So that's fun. It really expands the options for all players. The Severed Hand are seafaring adventurers. Their kingdom was destroyed by bad guys, by the faction Darkness. And so that is the severing, where the hand of Camarilla or whatever the fantasy world is. the hand was like these merchant fleets that like had this massive, awesome trade network. And then when the king or emperor was killed, they were severed and have fractured into mercenary warbands. So that's why they call themselves the Severed Hand. And they are, I've got two rogues, a fighter class character and a wizard. And they are really inspired by Southeast Asian and Southeast Asian piracy. Not explicitly from our world, but, you know, there's inspiration from there. The rogues have Filipino-style knives and, you know, just like trying to bring in more diverse, fun, you know, fantasy adventure.
Yeah, they're really cool looking. I haven't really seen a warband looks like them before. I'm really, really impressed with that.
Yeah, I really, you know, I've always liked more like basic trooper adventurers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that makes sense. Like I love Warhammer Empire, where they seemed like basic guys in a world of horrible magic. And I always liked the, you know, rebel trooper and the stormtrooper rather than the Jedi fighting.
Yeah.
So in Relic Blade, a lot of the characters represent more of that like low adventurer. And I think this warband really brings that fun vibe to it, where they're like
the sea mistress kind is such of a cool humble figure.
Oh yeah, that figure was really fun. Another moment of like hoping to to bring some fun diversity of having like a grandma hero.
Yeah, I love it. It's something you don't see a lot of in miniatures, and I think she's really really compelling. You know, just because of that, but she's just a cool figure in and of herself.
fun to paint too. And I was surprised because I sent out samples to quite a few people, like not a ton. Because I feel weird about it. Like I don't want to be taking advantage of anyone. But sent out samples to friends, and that was like the first model that they painted. Yeah, I was like really excited cool. about her. So
some great deal. I like she got like the book on her belt, and it's like big prayer beads or something. I don't know. She's really cool.
Yeah, and because in Cursebreaker the like the books you choose are important, I wanted to feature the books prominently on the wizards that come in.
No, that's very, very cool.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you've got the severed hand, and they are facing off against the guild champions.
Yes, and the guild champions are like very different. Like I was talking about liking the low level heroes, the champions are like really as high level as Relic Blade goes.
Yeah,
they come from the Twilight Seat, which is the like center of governance for the new elven races.
Mm-hmm.
So like in the lore, Relic Blade's like sort of post-apocalyptic where the surviving fortress cities are besieged by a world that's ravaged by magic and the wilderness is too powerful and there are monsters everywhere. Basically a setting where you walk out your door and there's you fall into a tomb and there's adventure there. Like just adventure underfoot. Everywhere you go, you're walking on the bones of heroes. So the elves, like full-on Tolkien, whatever elves, when the world ended, they suffered like they were severed from their like divinity and basically just chose to die. They just died. Like the elders were like, no, we're out and left, right? And so they became essentially like an orphan race because their perfection was made through like rituals and magic to like bring them through stages of puberty and into their like completion as elves that could, you know, move faster than you can see and see farther than is possible and all of hear perfectly, all of those like tropes of elves being perfected in Relic Blade happened through tightly guarded secrets. And so when the elders die, they lost all those secrets. And so they're like an orphan race of eternally underdeveloped beings and hypersensitive to magic. So they're in a tough spot because there's a lot of evil magic in the world. And so it's easy for them to go crazy. And so they reorganized, came to a place called the Twilight Seat, organized themselves into guilds, and each guild is trying to create new pathways for them to mature through magical augmentation. And so that experimentation has led to these different disciplines of creating like really high level champions. And so there's the first Twilight Seat character or Lotus Guild character that I made was called the Lotus Blade Song. And they've found magic swords that were talking to them in the Fey realm, brought those back and learned from the spirits that were held in the swords. So very cool. Who wouldn't want to create a new martial tradition from what swords teach them?
That's the dream.
And then, exactly. Then there are, in the new set, you get the Artificer. And they come from the tradition of the smiths that were making magic items. And their development and path is to use their tools and new weapon creations to augment themselves.
Is he the pistolier?
Yeah, so he's got
a
pistol that can fire like basically like arcane bolts. Like a wizard could probably do that, but he loads cartridges into a gun and shoots arcane bolts.
I mean, I'm a sucker for an elf with a gun.
Oh yeah, exactly. You can't go wrong. Like, and game mechanics wise, that's kind of fun because it casts as a spell, which means you don't get cover saves against it. So it's better than a gun.
Yeah.
Because it ignores cover and you can shoot it while engaged. So pretty good.
Right on.
then, and like he has a robot arm, obviously, like things haven't always gone great. And I use a lot the faction sets to develop various upgrades. So quite a few of the upgrades are related to this Smith keyword for the artificer. And I already have the gnome battle smith. So the gnomes have been kind of, the gnome smiths have been paying for a keyword that there are no upgrades for years and years. And so this is really going to be fun to show you guys, like, oh, you remember that gnome that was like suboptimal? He was suboptimal because I meant to write this and it's taken years, and now he'll have these sweet powers and upgrades. So that's a fun, like, rules thing aside. The other character is the Starsight, and they're archers that you like pay attention to the cosmos and are able to like use these giant bows. And it's a fun mechanic where, you know, the dice you roll, it's a little bit funny if you aren't like way into Relic Blade, but the difficulty for the bow, it like has to be shot fast, but it's highly difficult, and it'll be great. Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. The next character is the Talisman. And like I was saying about magic, is normally you have to be like, have like a patron that is your source of magic. And so the talismans use arcane symbols and sigils and gems and cursed items and whatever they can to obfuscate their identities and use trickery to steal power from the arcane. So he doesn't have the wizard stats. He's got 5 actions and he's speed 3. So he's like way more of an action character than most wizards. And then he can take 1 spell from any school of magic, which obviously has a lot of build opportunities where he can casting some of like the really powerful illusion spells, or, you know, any number of other, he could use darkness spells, because the sources of magic can't tell who he is, but they think that he's one of their friends. So that's sort of a fun
game. But most mechanic. Importantly, I want to hear about the bird.
The bird. Yeah. So in this world where everything's like sort of corrupted and changed by magic, there's like new animals, or animals that have been like changed. And so the storm heron they're essentially wild, just normal herons that have been adopted and changed by the source of the storm. And so now, I mean, in the wild, you just see them out fishing with lightning bolts, right?
Awesome. That's great.
But also because they have this magic source in them, they're way more intelligent than a normal animal would be. And so you can forge alliances with them. And so I don't think they can talk, but they definitely can understand.
Sure. It's such a cool figure. I love it. I really love in fantasy when you have creatures that are like just being animals but have magic powers that they can use too. And I think it's so cool to me. But the figure's beautiful.
Yeah, you know, I love to sculpt animals, and I always am trying to find a way to, you know, weave one more animal into the set, because I've got an ibex, a fox, a bear, and now a heron. It's a bunch of my favorites.
Don't forget the pack yak. I love my pack
yak. Oh, yeah, naturally, the yak. Just like all my favorite animals.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, that's very cool. And I think your studio figures, they were painted by Malav again?
Yeah, exactly. So I would like to work with Malav. He's one of my main like creative collaborators. Cursebreaker, I wrote solo, just like really exploring and playing with game design. But naturally, with anything I'm working on, I'll be on calls with him and like bouncing ideas off of him. And he did this studio paint job. So he does more than just paint.
He's a game designer in his own right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So, yeah. Two games at least under his belt, and also a Relic Blade supplement that he wrote most of. So, but yeah, it's been really, really terrific. And we've got great photos of his paint jobs on the Kickstarter page.
Yeah, it's all very, very beautiful stuff. I mean, as always, but I think it's a great looking set. But you were saying you did the design solo, but that's a great segue here, because this is you can play this game solo yourself, isn't it, for one player?
Yeah, so I wrote the game. I really, it's possible for people to think of a miniatures game as like a lifestyle hobby. Like you,
sure.
If you think of your 40K army, you're like, I better be able to play everything with this. But I'm really looking to deliver more of a specific experience and a specific adventure. So with Cursebreaker, there are 11 scenarios, and in one playthrough, you can attempt each scenario once. And obviously you can have multiple playthroughs. There's not, start multiple campaigns with multiple friends. It's very straightforward. It's not hard to start a campaign, but I wanted it to be an adventure where you explore different locations in the Shattered Lands and the curses there, and like some of the context of those curses and how they evoke. So with Cursebreaker, normally you are playing 2 to 4 players. It's kind of like a battle royale where you're laying down a bunch of different spells and bouncing off each other and creating like a really tangled puzzle for people to navigate and for you to win. And so with the solo play, instead of fighting against another player magician, you have a separate board of, or not board, but like a separate set of magic books and a separate pool of dice that belong to a shadow magician that is attached to you like a parasite and trying to kill you so it can use your body and get a body.
Uh-huh.
And so the reason your character has come to the Shattered Lands is to try and find a way to either break this curse or die somewhere where the shadow will be lost among countless other curses. Okay. So when you play solo, instead of playing against another player, you roll all of your power dice and your lore books, and then you roll the shadow magician's dice, and then the missions, why I brought up the campaign, the missions have active dice on the cursed objects. So each level is designed a little bit more active in that, like, the scenario is active. Different types of monsters will be summoned. Different types of curses will try and destroy you. And so the shadow magician's spells are usually making the scenario more difficult, hounding you, stealing dice from you, and trying to kill you the whole time. So it plays different in that you aren't playing against another player. It's more of the puzzle is complicated in that you're trying to do the scenario. You're trying to achieve your campaign objectives while also contending with a magician that is trying to kill you, and his physical location is just in your own body.
Uh-huh. Sure. So what are when you're playing that solo mode, obviously you've got your own wizard and their followers, but what other models would be on the table in that situation?
The scenario monsters. And then the shadow magician also, I think, can summon a couple of like shadow creatures. And those would, here, let's see. I probably have the Book of Shadows right here. Yeah. Yeah. So they can summon a malicious being, two malicious beings. So you can tell by the wording, you can use any miniature to represent a malicious being.
Yeah.
So you're being hounded by monsters that are chasing you down, and spells that are dealing direct damage and debuffs and things like that, and often buffing the other creatures that are trying to kill you because of your curse.
Sure. And how long does a game play? How long does it take to play a session?
That it's funny, I haven't really kept track. I bet it's close to an hour for a game.
Mm-hmm.
It's not super long. It's not super complicated. Yeah, and because this game has that element where you can see all the way to the end of the round, if you're playing and the stakes are high, I definitely think some players could get stuck in that like analysis paralysis. So I think this game, more than my other games, is designed with a more competitive edge in mind, because there's no random outcomes, right? So that means you know if that play is optimal. You know if it's going to succeed. You know if it'll deal enough damage. You know if it'll block a guy, slow down an enemy enough. You know. So like, because you can predict that stuff, it really opens up a lot of doors for playing a more competitive format. And I think for a competitive format, you'd just use a chess clock or something, you know, where you still have to think on your toes. So I think without a chess clock, it would matter if your opponent was being indecisive, but, I think an hour is enough time to just play a fun, exciting wizard battle puzzle. So
that's cool. Yeah, it's something. It feels very new to me. I can't think of another Miniatures game that's sort of taken this approach. I'm very excited to see it actually played.
It cracks me up because it isn't like other games that I've played. It doesn't play like Miniatures games but it doesn't play like exactly like board games I've played before either. So I just find it very fun, very stimulating. I have this funny feeling where. Like, this sounds so stupid, but maybe a gamer will get it. Like, I feel like I'm using my intelligence stat when I play. Like, I can tell that I'm, like, thinking differently and planning differently. But it's not, I'm not overworking my brain. I'm not having to keep track of too many things. And I'm not, none of it's, like, going over your head. The spells are usually, like, very straightforward to execute and the effects are very straightforward, but you just get this feeling like you're being a wizard. Malev and I played a game today and recorded it. And
very engaged with the game, right?
Yeah. At one point while we were playing, he just was looking at his options and then just had to say, he's like, this game's so fun. And it was a very rewarding moment for me as the designer, because I feel like that when I play. And I don't, you never know, because you create these moments, but you can't explain them to people because you have to be in the moment, seeing your options. And then you're like, oh my gosh, I'm having an adventure. And I get a totally different thing where I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm a wizard.
I'm looking at the pictures of gameplay. There's some really cool objectives and stuff. Are those things that are available as well? Like, you've got this great little demon altar.
That is presently available as an STL on my website. But like, there's funny mold making issues with that sculpt. So I haven't put it into production, where just like there would be undercuts and there are design things that I just haven't decided that I want to compromise on.
I love it. The little like flaming toad demon.
It comes with two different heads. It has a head where its mouth is open and flames are shooting out of its eyes, has a like mouth closed, eyes closed version, and then it has a set where the head is totally removed as an option.
Very
so
cool.
You can like show it activated or inactive or destroyed for scenario purposes.
Oh, that's awesome. That's very cool. And I know you got the braziers with the flame, and those around for a while. So do those kind of tokens, are those like objectives in the game, or they just set dressing?
Yes. Some scenarios use them, and it's like applied different ways. So those have a flame that can be put on them or removed. And so like, I think in some scenarios, like there's a scenario called the Necromancer's Gallows, and you enter this place where a Necromancer Lord has been drawn and quartered. And so the four parts of his body are the four cursed objects. And then those cursed objects summon tons of skeletons, obviously. And the center of the board has a brazier that can be activated to create like a light source that will deal damage to undead. So you have like this one little bubble that you can hide at if you get totally overwhelmed. So that's one example of how the brazers are applied in a scenario. But other ones, it'll be like, in one of them, you're in a ziggurat of the Akkadian goblins. And when the brazers are activated, it becomes quicksand around them. And so that's obviously a problem.
Yeah. So how many scenarios are there?
11.
Wow, that's a good amount.
Yeah, so I think it's fun. Two of them are like high level adventures where you have to complete one of the other adventures to unlock the high level area. So like you have to go through a gladiatorial fight to get into the tomb of this like Templar. And another one is you have to, I forget exactly, you know, just fun, normal stuff, adventure stuff. You got to make your way into the lost temple of Agog somehow. Oh no. If you kill the catacombs, if you kill the Templar, then you can get to the Imperium Palace and try and challenge God. So I don't know how well that'll go for you, but
so the scenario, the gameplay is linked.
Yes. Yeah. There's continuity through campaign, and the overarching goal is to achieve campaign objectives. And so you've got a list of objectives that will like grow your character's understanding of magic. Right. So like simple stuff like breaking 10 curses over the course of the campaign. Right. Or another one is to win a game only using one lore of magic. Because you can choose between 1 and 5. But if you only have 1, obviously you're very limited options. And if you have 5, you only have 1 die assigned to each different lore. And so you have very unreliable options. And so there's an achievement of winning with 5 lores of magic, an achievement for only doing 1, or an achievement for having 10 creatures under your control. So you're trying to do these things throughout the course of the campaign. And as you achieve, for every 3 you achieve, you start the game with 1 additional power die. So it's like, it's a very significant boon to, as your character levels up. And you also have champions that are like really powerful allies that will help you.
Cool.
And treasure, obviously treasures, like you can get a magic carpet, fun stuff like that. An immense turban.
That is cool.
But yeah, the intention is definitely like inspired by the fact that I really like to play video games that have levels and you play the whole thing, and it was designed to be very fun and very rewarding. And if you loved it, you can play it again. Rather than making a game that's like under the assumption you'll play infinite games of the same scenario with slight variations against your friends. It's like, I'd much rather have it be a specific thing. You don't need to own a ton of miniatures to play my games. And I want you to have maximum fun. And for me, maximum fun includes having specific fun instead of just like an open world where you can have fun if you can figure out how to have fun.
Sure. No, that's all very cool. I'm very excited to get my hands on this game. What I was going
to
ask.
Oh, and like a key to that, a key to that, like a campaign achievement system is if you're playing in a campaign with, you know, four players or 5 players, it's very easy to calculate who won, who achieved the most and got the most power by the end of the game. So, or end of the campaign. So there's also very specific outlines for like how to win over the course of those 11 games, which I think is important. It's easy to end up in a situation where you played a bunch and then you're like, well, who really won Mordheim? I don't know.
Right.
It was the friends you made along the way.
Yeah. What I was going to ask, so I know obviously you can play this game with the Severed Hand and the Guild Champions, but if I have, you know, say my Moldorf Dwarves, can I use them in this game?
They're actually a really good set for Cursebreaker because
you
get a magician, you get a fighter champion and a rogue champion, and you get an illusory horror, which is one of the things that can be summoned with the Book of Dreams. So the bibliothecary is an illusionist, and the Book of Dreams is their like source of magic. So straight out of the pack, you have like a really great set. Same with the Kingdoms of Akkad, because it comes with a magician, two fighter champions, and a water elemental, which you summon. So like there are certain Relic Blade packs that are like really perfect for Cursebreaker. And these two sets that I'm delivering in the Kickstarter are carefully designed so that both you have two magicians and you have more than you have one of each type of champion, and the Storm Heron is one of the types of creatures that can be summoned also. So it's all useful. I wasn't shy about having adventures where you use more figures. So some players will want to, instead of having multiple Gilblins in their collection, we'll just use goblins from their Warhammer collection or from their D&D collection. Sure. And that I'm totally like it rules as written. Reskin it. You're fighting spiders instead of goblins. That's totally fine. But at the same time, I'm going to make sure there's a nice set of paper miniatures to go with it. So if someone is backing like just digital or just the rules, they'll be able to print up like a really nice Cursebreaker set that's using my art and will deliver a very fun, specific Sean Sutter experience.
Super cool. And talk about the game symbol. Let's talk about the Kickstarter, which is already a big success. Yeah. You your funding goal is I think 35,000, and you're currently over 90.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm in that middle stage where like no one cares.
Yeah, it slows totally down fine. That U-shape. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm at 90,000 now, which is awesome. I've got 678 backers at this moment, which is terrific. You know, my last Kickstarter, I landed at around 800 backers at the end. So we're definitely on track to like at least have the same number of fans as I did, you know, 2 years ago. And I'm excited about it because, you know, I'm making what I want to be making. And like very few people get to just have fun and be like, oh, today I'm interested in wizards, and just do that. And, you know, I can't sell it too short because it also includes just an incredible amount of follow through to say, I like wizards, and then end up with, you know, a book and cards and all of the graphic design and all of the videos and all of the work to turn it into a product. Sure. But at the same time, I'm so grateful because printing books is so expensive. You know, I had to reprint the core rule book this last year, and like just suddenly being expected to drop $15,000 on reprinting books, and your alternative is to just stop having a game. Like that's a tough situation as an indie person. And, but because my fans like it and recognize my passion about it, and they're getting a fun experience out of it, I think we've created a really fun community. And obviously, like it's very special for me to be able to come to Kickstarter and reliably have my fans show up. 'Cause I've seen a lot of projects that deserve attention, you know, have passion, have just as much love put into them. And it just, it's not, I don't take it for granted, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I really am so grateful.
No, I think it's the community around Relic Blade and all of your projects at this point, you know, I think people really respond to just the fact that, you know, it is basically just you with a little bit of help doing this whole game in itself. And I think it's such a labor of love. People really respond to that. And it's part of why I like it so much. You know, it shows through in every aspect of the game how much you care about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're in inflation is not a secret, but also you kind of forget that it affects fun stuff too.
Yeah.
And lately, like a lot of people are really bummed about how expensive things are. And I'm one of them. And like, I'm bummed that it's so expensive for me to make games. It's so expensive to keep up with groceries and like make dinner. And so all of that stuff is so frustrating. And so it's very special that even now, you know, people are investing their fun money in something like Curse Breaker, which is a game they've never heard reviewed. They've never played. They've never even seen it played. Because like I'm so limited on how many videos I can put together and how many websites I can write. Like I have a nice section on my website explaining a breakdown of the rules, but you know, you kind of have to take my word for it. And so the fact that people have limited fun money and are willing to take a risk and invest in me when frankly, like that fun money is competing with beer. Like it's competing right. with every, I'm not just competing with Warhammer. I'm not just competing with Helldivers. I'm not just competing with Dune 2. I'm competing with like literally everything people enjoy. And so, I think it's just so wonderful. And I think it's so great that people invest in it. And I also live that way where try and really recognize where I'm spending that fun money because mm-hmm. it's, you know, Disney, bless their heart, will probably be okay if I don't
right.
buy a Disney product. And if that's something I want, I'll still get it.
Sure.
But it's cool to think like you can buy something like Dungeon Degenerates and be supporting an independent artist and get a really wacky thing out of it. So I try to think that way when I'm investing my fun time.
Sure.
But
that's great.
That's obviously just stuff I'm always thinking about. And when people complain that stuff's expensive, I always want to go, I know, right?
Yeah.
Just think how fun it'd be for me if I could make it cheaper. Like more people would be able to get it.
Yeah.
But it's not. I've gone to extreme lengths to make it possible for people to play my games.
Yeah. So like, no, I think your games are very accessible as these things go. And I think you've done a really great job on that so far.
And the paper miniatures are really a fun part of that. Cause
yeah, it's so cool. You're doing that.
They're like cute and fit the whole aesthetic so well because they are drawn by me and the cards are drawn by me and the rules are drawn by me. So it doesn't feel like a cheap version of Relic Blade to me when I get to play with those. So, yeah, and I'll have paper miniature demo kits to pass out at Adepticon. So I don't know if this video or podcast will be published before the
20th. Yeah, it will be. So if you're listening to this, I should have to say, if you're listening to this podcast, and you're at Adepticon, make sure to go to Sean's booth for Relic Blade and Curse Breaker.
Yeah, hopefully I'll have a paper demo and you can throw down some dice.
Sweet.
That'd be and so actually, fun.
Do you know your booth number?
I could look it up, I guess, right? It must be in my email.
Well, if you can't find Sean, come find me at the Brush Worlds Union booth at booth 917 and I will direct you to Sean. But definitely go check it out and you won't just have Curse Breaker demos. You'll be having regular Relic Blade for sale as well, right?
Yeah, mainly. Relic Blade. I'll have like a sample of so people can look at Curse Breaker, and the Kickstarter will still be going. So it'll be a fun opportunity. I normally run very short Kickstarters, but the idea of people being like, "Hey, Sean, what's new?" and I'm like, "You just missed it." Like that didn't make sense. So I'll have the Kickstarter run until after I get home.
That's cool. All right. Well, thank you for joining me. And if you're listening, please check out the show notes. You'll have a link to the Kickstarter and to the main Relic Blade site. And please come see us both at Adepticon next week. So, Sean, thanks again, man. Always good to talk to you. Can't wait to get my hands on Curse Breaker.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to see you in person soon. It'll be fun.
Brush Builders Union is a community of like-minded miniatures gamers dedicated to playing their games fully painted and supporting one another in their craft. Brush Builders Union is here to help you stay on track with tools and a community of fellow painters to encourage you in your journey. Take the union pledge and learn more at brushbuildersunion.com.